The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, from new tech to a much older family business, founded in 1908, what was once a County Kilkenny mill has become a global brand specialising in feed for horses, pets, cattle and even camels. The company employs just shy of 400 people. Their products are distributed in 80 countries from Mexico to Mongolia. And I'm joined by Michael Connolly, the Global Strategy and Business Development Director of Red Mills. Michael, you're very welcome. 1908. Fascinating history. It goes back to your great-granddad, is it?
Yeah, my great-granddad, he was the same name as myself, Michael Connolly. He left Ireland at the age of 14. He was one of 12, and nine of whom had died of TB. So they literally couldn't afford to keep him. So he went to America on his own and ended up training horses in Long Island, New York.
That was just a job he got when he arrived there.
We know very little about exactly what happened, but we've been trying to research it. But I guess that experience, when he was finally invited to come back, he had seen the future. He had seen cars, he had seen telephones, he had seen electrification, something that wasn't to happen, until the 1950s, really, in Ireland.
So he could come back and say, this is what's going to happen here.
Exactly.
It's a bit like the song, The Streets of New York. The father is talking about the son going to New York,
exactly.
And he says, there's something you might learn or you might see, bring it back home, make it easy on me.
Yeah, and that's very much what he did. And I think he also had a massive impact on his sons and his grandson, who was my dad.
So he came back. And what did he do then? He got into business.
He was invited back by his parents who, as soon as he got home, he really just wanted them to come back to New York with him. But they were elderly at the time and they didn't want to move. And so he was an entrepreneur. So he took the shop that they had, built really very hard in Bagginalstown, County Carlow, and he expanded it into a bakery. He bought a farm, he became an auctioneer, and he was one of the thriving business people at the time to develop that business and grow that business. He had two sons, and the second son was a bit wayward, my grandfather, and he ended up buying...
Wayward?
Yeah, well, he got himself into a little
bit
of trouble.
That sounds like he was a bit of a boyo.
Was a bit of a boyo, yeah, but he got himself into a bit of trouble and his dad had to bail him out. And then he said, listen, I'll tell you what, you can make the flour for the bakery. And so Smithick's had a mill in Goresbridge, County Kilkenny, which was about 10 miles away. And they ended up buying the mill for £400 in 1908. And that's how Red Mills got started. Red Mills was one of many, many mills in the southeast of Ireland, which really is the breadbasket of Ireland.
And so it would have been the Smithick's family, basically,
exactly,
that would have owned it.
So what had happened was in the 1840s, 1850s, there was a thing called the repeal of the Corn Laws, which allowed cheap American grain to come in, and it devastated the Irish grain industry, which had been feeding the Industrial Revolution in the UK and had been a very buoyant business up to that time. So in 1908, the mill was relatively obsolete and he bought it for relatively small money.
And then he was going to make a go of it. Not easy, I'd imagine, though, because there was a lot of change at that time.
Really, really difficult. I mean, he bought it in 1908, you had the First World War, then you had the Spanish flu, then you had the Great Depression, then you had the Second World War, and even into the 1950s. So really, throughout his life, he was fighting battles at all times.
So your father then growing up, that would have been his dad's business.
Exactly.
It wasn't exactly easy times, dad's a businessman, we're making loads of money here.
Not at all, no. I mean, it was literally scraping a living together. But my dad recited to us all and I think this gave us all a huge sense of drive, and he had a huge sense of drive. He left the table hungry. I mean, he remembered times during the war years, during the so-called emergency, that they literally didn't have enough to eat. And he said, that's not going to happen again. And also there was his sister Claire died tragically, and my grandfather looked at him and kind of, he spent the rest of his life proving himself to his dad that he could make a success of it.
So, and what about the switch then from the mill and baking and cereals into horse feed?
Yeah, well, strangely enough, that realizing that, in the ordinary milling industry in Ireland, there wasn't really great opportunities, he looked for new opportunities and thought he'd found one in the breakfast cereal business. So he launched in the late 50s, early 60s, 1960s, he launched Red Mills Breakfast Cereal, possibly following in the footprints of Flavin's Mills, who did make a success of it. But at the same time, Kellogg's Corn Flakes came out with their wonderful product, of course, well-structured to match the industry that was being structured in the Irish supermarket industry. And that pretty much put the kibosh on our ambitions in the breakfast cereal business. But necessity being the mother of invention, he went to his school friend, Paddy Mullins, who was only a mile away. Paddy was the father of the Mullins dynasty.
In the horse industry.
Exactly. And Paddy and himself had been in national school together in the small village in County Kilkenny in Goresbridge, and Paddy taught him how to count using his fingers. So Liam had this idea that they would use the steam cooker which he had bought to make horse feeds, or to make breakfast cereals, to make horse feeds. And that was the beginning of an industry. It was the first formulated and processed horse feed for racing horses that we know of in Europe at the time. There may have been one in America at the time, but certainly we were, if not the first, one of the first.
And when you're talking about horses and feed, and you're talking particularly about high performance horses, race horses, that sort of thing, what goes into the food is so important for them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just about energy and it's not just about fuel. Basically, the nutrition is rebuilding the horse from the inside. So getting the protein balance right, the amino acid profile right, all of the high-tech nutrition right. But that one could say that about any animal nutrition. And certainly when you're feeding cattle and pigs and poultry, those things are well measured. But when it comes to feeding racehorses, it's about getting the horse across the line. And there's another factor, which is, of course, doping. Accidentally doping a horse due to contaminants in feed. And in the 1980s, as early as the 1980s, my dad invested so heavily in technology, which we have really brought to an Olympic standard, testing for prohibited substances. And another strange
something
thing
that can get into the food
exactly,
chain,
yeah.
Seeds or something,
caffeine,
from something else.
Caffeine, morphine, scopolamine, atropine, there's so many that can even naturally occur, hordenine, even in barley.
So the experience then that your dad, Liam, had when he latched on to and discovered the horse feed business and things began to go very well and the company began to expand, was that a big source of pride to him, given that you were saying he really wanted to prove to his own father that he could do it, there was something there for him?
I don't think you could ever accuse him of being proud. Maybe one or two times, and there was a wonderful, I think he was more grateful that he had survived and that he had been successful. I don't think he was ever an arrogant man. And I think he passed that on. We would not be, you know, normally thought long and hard about coming on today, but I think it's a great show and I've been listening to you for years, even from Dubai. But Liam, I remember one time my mum and I were in the kitchen and the house was right in the middle of the factory. So we were business as soon as we went out the door, and also even at the kitchen dinner table. But my dad was very quiet, and I said, "Dad, are you okay?" And I might have been only 14 at the time. And my mum said, "You know, Michael, I think you should go." And my dad had burst out crying. And I said, "Why? What had happened?" But that very day, he just finished the completion of the double pelleting factory, which he knew would see the future of the business for 20 years.
So he suddenly felt he'd got it all over the line, and from 1908. And what was it like growing up with all that around you, growing up around the factory?
Well, we thought everybody else was the same as us, but because we were working in the shop from the age of seven, probably stealing a few lollipops as well while we were down when nobody was looking. And business was the very nature. That's what you did when you got up in the morning. There was chickens, there was hens, which are now all high-tech manufacturing facilities. And only last year, the house was finally knocked because I think there was too many ghosts in it for the family to go back to. But the house was literally in the middle of the factory.
And it was all expanding
expanded. There's 11 acres under shed, under roofs in Goresbridge, County Kilkenny. We have another facility in Goran and another kind of multifaceted facility.
We were talking about Kilkenny. Tough summer jobs. Did you have a few tough summer jobs?
I did, yeah. I tried to get away as much as I could, but all my kids too have come through the harvest lab. That was when you really got to meet the farmers and got to see the whole scale of the business and to work together, I think, as the family. And it was just, it was the way we were, and it was what we wanted to achieve. And that drive was pushed into all of us, all of the brothers. And my brother Joe, who's a fantastic engineer, who's designed and built so many of the machines. My brother Bill, who's an agronomist and a great trader. And my late brother John, who was the scientist, he was the real brains of the factory and went and did an MSc in animal nutrition in the Routt Institute in Aberdeen.
Right, so they've all done a lot. And as more buildings were going up, commercial buildings and factories around the house, was it sort of blocking out the house?
No, well, I think my mother, we used to get these hazy kind of snow screen TV channels from the UK, which would come off the top of Mount Leinster. And it was like literally there was snowing on the television, but you could just about get BBC. And the more factories and the more buildings went up, my mother would be giving out, the reception on the TV is dreadful. You know, what are you doing building another shed? But my dad put every penny back into the business and grew the business as much as he could.
And what about you then? Was it always on the cards that you would go into the family business, or what did you want to do?
Certainly not. I was the black sheep among black sheep, I guess, because we're all individuals, very much so. So I was a timid young guy growing up. I guess I was always looking for meaning and looking for my place in the world. And I finally chose, I was in school in Dalsall, Waterford, and went into St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, to study for the Diocese of Kildare and Loughlin at the age of 18, which is very countercultural today, but in that time it made perfect sense to me anyway. And I have to say I got out of it what I needed, but I didn't go through the full way. I was 5 years there.
After 5 years. And then you went into journalism. You worked...
That's right. Briefly, I went to work in the Kilkenny People newspaper and under John Kerry Keane and learned a huge amount just about writing, which was to serve me very well in the long run.
Was school difficult for you? How did you get on?
Yeah, I used to have to work harder than everybody else because I always had a problem spelling. At the time, we didn't know what it was, but today, I think it's recognised as some form of dyslexia, which is an umbrella word. I still struggle. Anybody who reads my emails knows that there's words missing or there's misspellings. As long as I get the sense of the message across, it's fine. But I think dyslexics think differently. We don't approach things the same way, and I think it's probably an advantage in business rather than a disadvantage. But not one as a journalist when you're asked to proof the newspaper and you're never asked again.
Yeah, well, sometimes that happens, and there isn't any dyslexia involved. And you decided then you were going to join the family business, and your first assignment from your dad was to look at expanding and overseas, and you went to Germany.
There was a lot of, my brothers were already well ahead of me and well much more experienced than I was in the business at the time, and they were learning all their skills and contributing hugely. So the one place where I couldn't do any harm was in exports as well. So I was dispatched to Germany. I went off, learned German, and got to understand the market. I mean, I had no training. I had no idea. It was one of the families. Sure, look, you can go ahead and do it. And I think that was the whole thing. And I think the Maynooth experience gave me certainly the experience, well, you can have a go at anything. And I think that's what education should do. Germany was the wrong market. We made every mistake in the book. But over the next, and it took 15 years to take away all the reasons why people wouldn't buy your horse feed. I mean, it was the wrong language, the packaging didn't mean anything, we didn't have the shelf life, we didn't have all of the technology that we've had today.
So it was a long learning process. And then one of the advantages, though, of being in horse feed and looking at international markets is the success of the horse industry in Ireland, and there are Irish people kind of all around the world working in it. Did that really open doors then?
And I think it's not just a wonderful success of the Irish industry, which is worth somewhere in the region of 800 million euros exports to Ireland annually and employs 35,000 people. It's not just that. It's also that Irish people will help you abroad, from Korea to Japan, Harry Sweeney in Japan, Pat Brady, and so many people in Europe, because the whole industry and the Middle East is punctuated by Irish people who emigrated with their horses and with the success of the industry. It's one that we really succeed in.
Some of the more interesting markets that you guys operate in, for example, are from the Middle East, but also Mongolia?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was probably the most interesting business trip that I've ever done. 19 hours in a jeep from Ulaanbaatar East. These people really know more than one could possibly imagine about horses, and just learning about their culture. And the one thing that you find, regardless of where you go, when you're working with horses and people, it's the love of horse. And
they that's have that history that we share. Of horse culture.
It's shared in the Middle East. I would say in certain markets like Hong Kong, it's more about a business. But certainly where you find common ground is loving horses.
Finding Irish people in different places around the world. South Korea, a priest, Father McGlinchey.
Oh, that was an amazing story. What an amazing man. And actually, my brother Joe is in Donegal at the rally today in Donegal. And he stayed with his niece yesterday. So who was this guy? Father PJ McGlinchey was an Irish priest who emigrated in 1941. And he went, was sent as one of the Columban Fathers to this small island in South Korea, and realized these people were hungry. So instead of preaching to them, he built businesses with them. And among other things, he built a stud farm. And they were our first customer in Korea, in South Korea.
And that connection once again.
Absolutely fantastic.
The Middle East is, I presume, a big market, potentially a big market as well. And for you, you are based there now. You live in Dubai.
Well, I was doing this awful trek, 23 hours door to door, from maybe 8 to 10 times a year, and doing anything up to 100 and 120 flights a year. So I was in the air all the time, building this business, growing, finding opportunities, with tremendous support from my brothers and my nephews, John and Gareth, and now Paul has joined the company. I think the big thing about being relocating to Dubai, which I did just before COVID, we had to do it. We had to set up a company because fires burn fast in the desert and two distributors were fighting, and we really had to get in there and referee this huge potential market. And at the time, I really thought it was going to be a jail sentence being so far away from home. But in fact, I love it. And I think spending time in Dubai, such a positive place, so many dreams are possible in Dubai that you couldn't dream anywhere else.
But it's a very different place and a very different culture too, Michael. I mean, Dubai, you know, talk about it, built on indentured labour, you know, people brought in from India and places like that, their passports taken off them, terrible working conditions.
I don't think you can say that precisely about the UAE or Dubai, which has come a long way, but certainly that there would have been an aspect of that in the past. And one can only say in a lot of cases, how bad is it at home when these people come? So, you know, you can go to Dubai today and you sit in a taxi, you'll talk to a taxi driver, normally from Pakistan, and you say, do you like it? How long have you been here? 17 years, sir. Do you like it here? Yes, sir. Is the money good? Money is okay, sir. So why are you here? Because it's safe, sir. You know, so how bad was it for a lot of these workers from where they were? I'm not trying to...
He still feels the need to call you sir, though.
Yeah, but it's a cultural thing. I mean, at home they call people sir as well. I know, and I mean, you can't say, please call me Michael, you know.
In relation to the horse feed and that part of the world, camels, I mean, they're obviously big into their horses in the Middle East. But what about the camel feed business?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's another wonderful thing. So we have social welfare here. We have redistribution of wealth. In the culture of the Middle East, in the Arabic culture, you know, charity of that kind could be rather insulting, especially within families. So one wonderful way that the rich sheikhs, religious and political sheikhs, have found to redistribute their wealth is through the camel industry. So there's 260,000 camels in the UAE and around the same in Saudi. And the sheikhs have invested, there's 8 racetracks in the UAE, for example, but there's 40 for horses, but there's 41 camel racetracks. And so they use the camel industry as a way to redistribute wealth to their poorer counterparts, poorer members of the family. And so camels can be hugely valuable. But selling to that market is a completely different story. It's a Bedouin culture. Science can be insulting, but yet they employ some of the most advanced scientific methods in the world. It's such a paradox. It's a market we still have to conquer, I think.
You haven't tried racing any of them yourself, no?
No, but actually we sponsored a female camel race recently. I mean, not the female camels, but it was female jockeys on the camels. So that was kind of a funny experience just to see it. It's a wonderful industry, very different. But generally speaking, there's no jockeys nowadays, and it's very advanced.
And the future of the business, it's a family firm. Your brothers are heavily involved in running the company, their children, your nephews. What about yourself and your own children? Would you like to see your kids getting involved in it?
Well, I think that, you know, businesses grow, and at this stage, I think it's going to be a very interesting next period. We've been through the most difficult time in business. We spent the last week, for example, just in conclave in County Carlow, just trying to figure out where the future was. All of our international sales managers were over, and I think we finally see that there's potential to really get back there, and I think it's looking quite positive at the moment. It's great to see leadership coming from my nephews, Gareth and John, and Paul coming in, especially on the IT side and the whole digitalisation side, and I think that's really fascinating, and it's great to see it. And it's great to see how they leverage off our success. But my own kids, I think they want to do their own thing. I think it can get complicated within family businesses. But also I think that the best days are building a business from scratch and, you know, and up to a certain point. At this stage, I think Red Mills is quite a large company, and it's got certainly huge challenges ahead of it, and it's not necessarily for everybody, but they're very welcome to come into the company, and I think they know that.
And since 1908, it's certainly been going a long time, and no doubt it sounds like it's going to keep that way. Michael Connolly of Red Mills, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.